Okay, our next case on this morning is docket number 62649, Barber v. State. Ms. Dickinson, are you ready to proceed?
Your Honor, if I could reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Yes.
May it please the Court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Jacquez Barber. Jacquez challenges his convictions for burglary and grand larceny, originally arising out of a petition filed in juvenile court and then certified up to the adult district court. There is a space that exists between what happens in the juvenile court and a case that is certified up to the adult district court. And that space is an area where this court has not made any decisions. They have not addressed it yet. That space is called jurisdiction. This is an important issue because a juvenile court cannot waive a case up to district court unless that juvenile court has jurisdiction. In this case, we contest it did not. Subject matter jurisdiction cannot be conferred by the parties. It can be raised at any time, including on appeal. In this case, the district court never obtained jurisdiction, and so both of these convictions must be reversed. And the reason they didn't is because the certification order was void. A court derives jurisdiction from the Constitution, the Nevada Constitution, the statutes that are in place. The Nevada Constitution gives the district court jurisdiction, original jurisdiction, over all criminal cases, except those excluded by law.
Can I ask you a question? There's an indication that the defendant waived his right to certification and that the juvenile court granted the state's petition in that regard. How does that figure into this?
That's a good question. Jack waived his right to a certification hearing. A juvenile cannot waive their right to jurisdiction. Only the juvenile court can do that. So he waived the right to contest and have the hearing and allow the juvenile court to then make determination of waiving jurisdiction. So, and we, in our issue too, we argue that waiver was not valid. It wasn't knowingly made. But even if he had made a valid waiver, it's still the juvenile court that has to make the decision.
He had a lawyer, though, didn't he? He had a lawyer when he waived.
He did have a lawyer.
Was it a public defender or was it a...
It was a public defender. He did.
So why are you handling this appeal if that was a public defender? You're saying that it sounds like the public defender didn't know what he or she was doing when they waived certification.
No, actually, what I'm saying is that the juvenile can make a waiver, but the court has to make a decision. He can only waive the right to contest and present evidence. It's the juvenile court that makes the decision. I think I cited a case that would explain that. I think it's a case out of Washington. But the juvenile court has to make that decision, just like a district court would make a decision when you make a plea. Was it knowing and voluntary?
So what did he actually waive?
He waived the hearing. He waived the hearing where he would contest the evidence presented. He said, I just want to go to trial. I just want to do this quickly. So that was what he waived. He did not go ahead and, because you can't waive jurisdiction. A person can't. It has to be a court.
I'm just having trouble understanding this argument. In other words, he has a lawyer, and he's before Judge Roy, I assume.
I think so.
The DA is trying to certify him because
right.
He's 17 years old, and this is when it happened, when he was 17.
The incident happened when he was 17, and they found out that he was a possible suspect in this before his 18th birthday, and they filed a petition. They found out because he was arrested on another case, which was an automatic pleading in the district court, so it did not go to the juvenile court. And then when they did his fingerprints, they said the palm print from the outside of a window showed up on the burglary grand larceny case. What happened down in juvenile court was they waited 15 months before they proceeded on the petition.
How old was he when he waived?
He was, he would have been 19, I believe, 19.
What happened during 15 months? Where was he?
He was in state custody. Nobody did anything. State let him sit there. His case, other case proceeded. He was sent to prison. And then finally one day, the state filed a certification order down in juvenile court. And it took two times. They finally brought him down there for the certification hearing. Under NRS 62D.310, the state were required to proceed on that petition within 1 year, actually within 60 days.
And counsel, that's an interesting element in this based on how our law is written. Was that just a goal of the statute? It seems to be silent as to what would happen if in fact the state didn't do so within that time frame. And the law seems to be split out there looking at the specificity of the law requiring that it be thrown out of court or something to that effect, opposed to just being something that the parties were trying to, a goal they were attempting to meet.
I believe the statute is clear that it's a mandate that the court cannot extend its proceedings beyond a year.
So but does it call for automatic dismissal? Does it call
for... It does not say automatic dismissal, but it says the court shall not extend the time for final disposition of the case beyond 1 year from the date in which the petition, the case, was filed.
As in the other jurisdictions, they seem to have very specific and explicit language as to what happens if you don't meet that obligation of timeliness.
This particular statute doesn't, but it doesn't allow you to extend it. And I would suggest it's like a statute of limitations. You can only go so far. It starts off with a 60-day rule. It says you have to have a disposition 60 days, and then it allows the court to extend it if it does certain specific things and files an order, but never can the court extend it beyond the one-year time period. And the state doesn't contest that. They agree that's what the statute says. They just merely say that if the juvenile court didn't have jurisdiction, then some other court had jurisdiction. And I don't believe that's what the case law refers. If you look at some of the case law interpreting the jurisdiction of the court, N.R. Stephen Daniel P., the juvenile court is limited to the provisions of this chapter for exercising authority. And in Carr versus State, but limits on the authority of the juvenile court when dismissing a petition, placing a child on informal probation. So this court has repeatedly limited the juvenile court's jurisdiction as to what's in the statute. And in N.R. Eric A., this court recognized a child's statutory right to have a final disposition of his case within 1 year. Now, this isn't like Jacques was running around in the community during this 15-month time period. He was in state custody. And I suggest that you look at the rules that we use in Hill and Bustos, and this court has said that if the state is not prepared, if they don't follow rules of procedure, then it is a dismissal with prejudice.
Well, does it say that in 62D.310.1? I don't see any language that indicates the juvenile court loses jurisdiction if the court doesn't comply with the particular statute.
Well,
is there language that I'm missing?
The statute does not say the words that you're talking about, but the statute says you cannot extend the time for final disposition of a case beyond 1 year from the date on which the petition in the case was filed. The final disposition was 15 months later. I read that section of the statute to say you just can't go any further. It's like a statute of limitations. The statute doesn't say what happens. You're correct, but I think it's very clear it has to be a dismissal with prejudice at this point.
Well, I don't think it says that at all.
Minnesota, Florida, Illinois, a number of states disagree with you. California kind of moves in the direction you're attempting to go in terms of statute of limitation, but we seem to have no jurisprudence set forth as to how we interpret Nevada. So we are interested in the argument you're putting forth.
I'm not sure what the juvenile court could do if it's beyond the 1 year and it says you can't make a final disposition. And a certification order is a final disposition under our case law. And if the court not only went beyond the 1 year time period, it really did not do a valid certification order, which I addressed. I think my 5 minutes is reserved.
Was any of this raised, though, before Judge Roy as to, hey, Judge, what are you doing extending this time?
No, it was not. So I'm arguing plain error because subject matter jurisdiction can be brought up at any time, and he did not have jurisdiction of the case. And it's,
see, that's why I asked the question about why the public defender's office is handling this case rather than private counsel or retained or alternate counsel, because of the lawyer should have done something. I mean, I had a situation like that where a kid was in justice court, and he wasn't ever certified, and I got him back to juvenile court, you know, right away. So I don't understand what the lawyer was thinking, the public defender was thinking, when they stood there with a guy who was in prison, had been in custody, in state custody, and was only 17 years old at the time. I'm just confused, Ms. Dickinson. I did this my whole career, and I can't figure out what the hell happened in front of Judge Voy that I can't understand why the DA even pursued it, to tell you the truth. He went to prison on another case, but that's not my business.
Well, that's correct, because this is a case where there certainly was not a lot of evidence that he convicted of crime. There was no witnesses. There was no suspects. There was no confession. All they have is a palm print on the outside of a window, nothing inside. And we have a CSI analyst, Warlong, who destroyed the crime scene. They found his fingerprints. So I'll reserve the rest of the time unless you want me to talk about the confrontation issue.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Hagar Trapedi, and I am counsel for the respondent in this matter. The first issue on appeal, as stated, is whether there was jurisdiction by the district court over this issue. And they're asserting that since the petition was filed May 13th of 2009, and the hearing was beyond that 1 year point, they at that time lost certification. The state, however, submits that the court need not consider those claims because appellant waived its right to challenge the certification order by not appealing. And he was placed on notice of his right to appeal. The certification order explicitly stated that the subject minor has the right to appeal this decision to the Supreme Court, and that notice of appeal must be filed no later than 30 days after the date of service of written order of the entry of this order. Appellant did not file any sort of notice of appeal from that certification order. And it's the state's contention that if appellant wanted to do so, he should have done so before the juvenile court within that 30-day limit as required by law. Lastly, there was no undue delay. The reason that he waived certification in the first place is because there was that district court case that he wanted to see if he could negotiate together and package them some sort of way. So he was to benefit from that. And the state contends that at this point, it's unfair for him to come back and now challenge the process. The second issue on appeal is...
But does the record show that he knew about the appeal? In other words, did the lawyer say to him, you have the right to appeal? Do we know anything about that as to what occurred?
Well, the certification order that he signed and received stated explicitly that he had the right to appeal within 30 days. So it was explicit. He was placed on explicit notice of that.
So really, you don't have any information on that until we have the post-conviction relief, if we affirm this conviction. would have post-conviction relief where the lawyer from juvenile would come forth and say what happened in juvenile court.
Correct.
Including, did you value your client of the right to appeal?
Correct.
Because he was a juvenile.
Correct. And I believe what you told counsel was correct in that the attorney should have, you know, advised his client of his right to appeal within that 30-day period. You know, but the attorney didn't do so. So it shouldn't be held against the state at this
point. Well, it may not be held against the state, but it goes to the whether or not the waiver by the juvenile is knowingly made, which is something we are concerned with in terms of that. This is another issue of first impression. How is the juvenile in our jurisdiction, how can they waive? And whether the court has to inquire as to the issues of knowingly making this waiver. So I guess I'm looking to see what the state's
right,
position is to the waiver issue, not whether or not they waived it, but does the court have to inquire of this juvenile to affirmatively find out what they have been told or not been told by their attorney in terms of making this decision, much like we do for adults?
Absolutely. And the state submits that the court, the juvenile court, did so. They followed the decisional matrix provided in the Seven Minors case, which this court has held provides several factors that should be considered in terms of whether a juvenile was placed on notice of his right to waive certification. The juvenile court properly considered the seriousness of the crime and stated it is a burglary of the home.
If we look at Seven Minors in this case only as to the certification, or did we look at the Seven Minors information as to, quote, the waiver element? And those are two different propositions.
And the state asserts that the Seven Minors case is related to the waiver aspect because there were certain elements that were provided that are consistent with the court's holding in Seven Minors. In Seven Minors, the court held that certain factors need to be addressed, such as the seriousness of the crime, appellant's past offenses, whether public protection would be served, and each of these factors was addressed in the instant case by the juvenile court. They considered burglary a serious crime, just as the court did in Seven Minors. In Seven Minors, the court stated, we consider burglary to be a very serious charge. It is the type of crime which, when considered with other factors, justifies the imposition of the punitive consequences found only in the adult system. So the juvenile court properly considered by stating on the record during the certification, it is a burglary case of a home, or a burglary of a home. They also considered appellant's past offenses and stated on the record there was some prior services in the juvenile system, referring to appellant's two prior offenses that were committed in 2008. They also considered his subject, his minor age. They noted on the record that he was a minor, and they considered public protection by noting on the record that public safety is a concern. So all of these factors that were from the decisional matrix in Reese 7 Minors were properly considered. Furthermore, the state contends that appellant's argument places a higher burden on the state than is necessary. The burden of the state is to establish that prosecutorial merit existed. And 7 Minors held that prosecutorial merit exists if there is evidence upon which a grand jury would be expected to return an indictment. It's essentially a probable cause standard. We submit that in this case, there was sufficient evidence. The appellant's palm print was found at the entry point to this home that where a burglary occurred. Another issue on appeal.
Can I bring you back just a little bit to the time frame here? Does 62D310 operate as a statute of limitations? This is another question that really hasn't been resolved in Nevada, and so I'm curious to see what your thoughts are in that regard.
It's the, you know, there is a one-year limit, but I don't think it's completely arbitrary. I think there are certain instances, such as this case, where we can go outside the one-year window. And let me make note of the fact
that... Is that a policy-driven presumption? Because there really isn't any case law that we've got here addressing that.
Essentially, it is. I just would like to note that the one-year time frame in this case was only extended 3 months beyond that date. So we're not talking about years and years of an extension between the time of the original filing and the time of the hearing on certification. Mm-hmm. So it's not a very great delay. And secondly, again, we'd like to submit that the appellant did not appeal the decision. He had the right. It's completely appealable decision. He had the right to appeal, and he did not do so. He was notified explicitly of his right to appeal. He did not do so. So at this point, we feel that this court should not even consider that argument.
Can you make any argument about the time frame should have been told at all as to... because of the factors that he was in custody and by the state?
There could have been several factors that contributed to the reason for the delay. One of those may have been his district court case. As you know, he was serving a prison sentence in High Desert while he was waiting for trial. And that could have certainly contributed to the delay. Am I going to make that the... sole reason? There could be several factors, so I don't want to really place one, you know, as the sole reason for the delay. But the bottom line is he didn't appeal that order. He didn't appeal the order, and he was placed on notice that he could appeal the order. Additionally, his speedy trial rights were not violated in any way.
Counsel, if we can shift you to away from that, that's kind of a non-starter for us, I think.
Okay.
To the sufficiency of sufficient evidence to convict and the advisory jury instruction that was not given. Because, as this counsel hit on, there was a palm print, that's it, nothing inside of the house, no confession, no property recovered from that person, that's it. So what do we have?
Certainly, but there was more than just a palm print in this case. The palm print was actually found at the point of entry into this home. So while it was outside, it was the window that was used to make entrance. We know, would you like me to continue
with
my response?
You have 5 minutes.
That was just a 5 minute warning.
Okay. We know that this was the point of entry because the water faucet underneath the window was broken, and the victim testified during the trial that it was not broken before she had left her home that day. A concrete jar was placed underneath the window, so that we know that the defendant climbed up and entered through the window.
How do we know that? Is that speculation? Because nothing was found inside of the house that indicates they were physically inside.
Well, I mean, we know that those items were moved because the victim actually testified at trial that they had not been moved before.
I understand that.
And
everything you said up to that point on the outside, we have this, the palm print was recovered, we have the broken area. What do we have thereafter once on the inside of the threshold, which says this person went into the residence, did something, and exited?
Right. And
do we have anything else?
The victim testified at trial that her home was completely ransacked.
And did she testify as to who did it?
She did not. But in most cases where a home burglary occurs and it's not a situation where it's a home invasion, you know, the burglary is discovered after the fact.
Did you have a circumstantial evidence instruction?
Yes, and we do in every single case, you know, ordering them to examine circumstantial evidence and to give it the same weight as they do direct evidence. So, but the state feels that there was overwhelming evidence that the burglary occurred. The fact that, you know, she testified that he wasn't anyone that she knew. He wasn't her gardener. He wasn't her window cleaner. He wasn't friends with her child or friends with her husband. There is no reason that person's palm print should have been at the entry point to this burglary. So other than the fact that he made entry and he was the person responsible for committing the burglary. And items were missing from the home. There was cash, a large amount of cash.
It's not contested, counsel, in terms of for a portion of it. In the restitution, that's a different story.
But I mean, unless there's video cameras and unless it's a situation where someone's actually caught in the act, it's almost impossible to actually, you know, have direct evidence that a burglary was committed. We need to look at the circumstances.
We have no palm prints or any prints from inside the home. We have no recovery of items in his possession after the fact.
Right, but there is indication that that was the window used to make entry because there were footprints found on the bathroom tile on the inner portion of the, it was a bathroom window that was used to make entry, and the tile extended all the way up to the window, and there were footprints going down.
Footprints were not linked to anyone else?
What was that?
The footprints were not linked to any individual?
They were not. There was no results as to those footprints that were found. But I mentioned that just to point out the fact that that was definitely the window used to make entry. And it's reasonable for the jury to conclude, based on all of the evidence, that the defendant was the one the appellant was the one that committed the burglary.
Let me ask you, actually, two more questions. Do you basically concede the fact that the restitution amount was incorrect?
Well, it actually is correct.
Showing $6,300 was proven, the other $700 was not explained or supported by the trial evidence.
Right, and we submit that the remaining $700 is attributable to the fact that items in the home were damaged or broken. The window was damaged. That was stated during the trial that the window was actually damaged and the water faucet outside of the home was broken.
So it's incorrect to say that it wasn't explained or supported from the trial evidence?
It is incorrect. We feel that it was supported.
Okay, very good. My other question is the claim of cumulative error and that the fact that the errors taken together, if we do in fact find error, warrant a reversal. Do you have anything to say about that?
We disagree with that in light of the fact that the evidence of guilt here was overwhelming.
One more time. The evidence of guilt was overwhelming based upon the handprint outside the window.
Based upon the handprint outside, yes. Based upon the fact that this is a burglary case where they had learned of the burglary after the fact, and the fact that the handprint was found at the point of entry. So that's our contention, yes, that it was found at the point of entry. It wasn't a handprint that belonged to the gardener that was found outside of the home. This is the handprint found at the point of entry, and the handprint belonged to someone that had absolutely no business being there.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, Ms. Dickinson, you have a couple minutes left. Looks like about 3 minutes.
I want to point out first that the 15-month delay had nothing to do with the case up in the adult court because he had already pled guilty the month before they filed the petition, and he was already sentenced a year before they filed a cert. So it had absolutely nothing to do with global negotiations. With regard to the fact that he did not file a notice of appeal of the actual cert order, I believe that the Castile case and the Turin case allow him to raise the same issues from the appeal of the judgment of conviction. Because in both of those cases, this court decided issues regarding a cert hearing from appeal of a JLC, a judgment of conviction. So I think that's moot. With regard to the waiver, I think there's two different tests at a certification hearing for waiver. The first one is, did his waiver of the hearing, was that knowingly, intelligently, voluntarily made? with an understanding of all the facts. I mean, we have a judge who did not explain to him the penalty. He did not explain the difference between adult court and juvenile court. He didn't explain anything to him, just asked him basically if he wanted a waiver. That's one part of the test. The second part is the court's actual decision. Decision is whether or not this case should be certified up. And we submit that the decision was an error because he based it solely on his age. With regard to the 15-month delay, we can know from the facts that it had nothing to do with global negotiations. And I've been arguing the statute suggests after a year the juvenile court loses jurisdiction. But there's another reason why it loses jurisdiction, and that would be the right to speedy trial. And I cited the New Mexico case, the Juan case, where a defendant was in custody. They didn't bring him into court for 15 months, and they said it was a violation because the person is in custody. So that, for the New Mexico court, was a violation of the right of speedy trial, which I think that the statute, the same way, it has limits on how long the court can continue something or make a decision.
My understanding was he had requested at least one continuance himself. Is that incorrect?
I haven't gone past the certification hearing. After you get past the certification hearing, you're correct.
Right.
So I'm arguing that it was violated even before we get to the district court by keeping him in custody for 15 months and not bringing him to juvenile court to stand for these charges. And then it was violated even further when you get into the adult court because it was, what, a year and a half, 2 years before he proceeded? With regard to the waiver in juvenile court, it's almost like waiving your prelim. You're saying you don't have to go ahead and put on a hearing, but it's a little more significant. If I could finish.
Go ahead and finish your statement.
It's a little bit more significant because you're just waiving the hearing. You're not waiving the decision.
I have one question just briefly. Seems to be a couple issues of first impression in this case, one of which is the issue that I posed to your opposing counsel earlier on the 62D310 and whether you feel it acts as a statute of limitations.
Yes, I do believe that it does. 62310, yes. The subsection, it limits their ability to proceed on that case. It first limits it for 60 days, requires them to, the court to go in and make another decision, and then it limits it after a year. I think it's a public policy reason. The statute of limitations is like our 60-day rule in the adult court for a speedy trial, but it does not allow for a waiver of that beyond the 1 year. I know that the state suggests that somehow or another it was waived. There's nothing to show that. They certainly could have came to court and said, we need a waiver. They didn't. They waited beyond that year. So I would say it's a statute of limitations for the juvenile court's jurisdiction.
Also, as my colleague has stated, there appears to be a conflict with the public defender's office doing this because there was also raised an issue that the defendant, in this case the juvenile, asked to have counsel replaced, and the court never got into why that was appropriate or not appropriate. It just didn't take any action, which kind of puts the state and the public defender's office in a strange place as to that issue.
That is correct. Those incidents did happen. What I'm arguing, which would not be a conflict of interest for our office, is that the court should have had a hearing and made a decision and allowed Jacques to state his position without the prosecutor being there and allowing his attorney to listen. And the court can ask the attorney questions. The way the procedure went, I feel, was incorrect under the Young and the Moore case because the court is supposed to stop the proceedings. Instead, we have the prosecutor objecting at one point. I don't know what right the prosecutor has to object when he wants to ask for a new attorney. So I'm arguing the proceedings were incorrect. I'm not taking position on whether or not, you know, the attorney was needed to be removed. I'm saying the proceedings needed to be handled differently.
Colleagues, any other questions? Okay, this matter will stand submitted. This court will stand in recess until tomorrow morning.